Through the window one could see kerchiefed peasant girls weeding a garden path on their hands and knees, or gently raking the sun-mottled sand. The happy days when they would be cleaning streets and digging canals for the state were still beyond the horizon. Golden orioles in the greenery emitted their four brilliant notes. D-del-D-O. Ned lumbered past the window in a fair impersonation of the gardener's mate, Ivan, who was to become in 1918 a member of the local Soviet. On later pages, longer words appeared, and at the very end of the brown, ink-stained volume, a real, sensible story unfolded its adult sentences. One day, Ted said to Anne, "Let us..." The little reader's ultimate triumph and reward. I was thrilled by the thought that some day I might attain such proficiency. The magic has endured, and whenever a grammar book comes my way, I instantly turn to the last page to enjoy a forbidden glimpse of the laborious student's future, of that promised land where at last words are meant to mean what they mean. 2. Summer Sumyarki. The lovely Russian word for dusk. Time, a dim point in the first decade of this unpopular century. Place, latitude 59 degrees north from your equator, longitude 100 degrees east from my writing hand. The day would take hours to fade, and everything, sky, tall flowers, still waters, would be kept in a state of infinite vesperal suspense. Deepened rather than resolved by the doleful moo of a cow in a distant meadow, or by the still more moving cry that came from some bird beyond the lower course of the river, where the vast expanse of a misty blue sphagnum bog, because of its mystery and remoteness, the Rukavishnikov children had baptized America. In the drawing room of our country house, before going to bed, I would often be read to in English by my mother. As she came to a particularly dramatic passage, where the hero was about to encounter some strange, perhaps fatal danger, her voice would slow down, her words would be spaced portentously, and before turning the page, she would place upon it her hand, with its familiar pigeon-blood ruby and diamond ring, within the limpid facets of which, had I been a better crystal-gazer, I might have seen a room, people, lights, trees in the rain, a whole period of emigre life for which that ring was to pay. There were tales about knights, whose terrific but wonderfully aseptic wounds were bathed by damsels in grottos. From a windswept cliff-top, a medieval maiden with flying hair and a youth in hose gazed at the round aisles of the blessed. In Misunderstood, the fate of Humphrey used to bring a more specialized lump to one's throat than anything in Dickens or Daudet, great devisers of lumps, while a shamelessly allegorical story, Beyond the Blue Mountains, dealing with two pairs of little travelers, Good Clover and Cowslip, Bad Buttercup and Daisy, contained enough exciting details to make one forget its message. There were also those large, flat, glossy picture books. I particularly liked the blue-coated, red-trousered, coal-black Gollywog, with underclothes buttons for eyes, and his meager harem of five wooden dolls. By the illegal method of cutting themselves frocks out of the American flag, Peg taking the motherly stripes, Sarah Jane the pretty stars, two of the dolls acquired a certain soft femininity once their neutral articulations had been clothed. The twins, Meg and Weg, and the midget remained stark naked, and consequently sexless. We see them in the dead of night stealing out of doors to sling snowballs at one another until the chimes of a remote clock, but hark, comments the rhymed text, send them back to their toy box in the nursery. A rude jack-in-the-box shoots out, frightening my lovely Sarah, and that picture I heartily disliked, because it reminded me of children's parties at which this or that graceful little girl, who had bewitched me, happened to pinch her finger or hurt her knee, and would forthwith expand into a purple-faced goblin, all wrinkles and bawling mouth. Another time they went on a bicycle journey, and were captured by cannibals. Our unsuspecting travelers had been quenching their thirst at a palm-fringed pool when the tom-toms sounded. Over the shoulder of my past, I admire again the crucial picture. The gollywog, still on his knees by the pool but no longer drinking. His hair stands on end, and the normal black of his face has changed to a weird ashen hue. There was also the motor car book. Sarah Jane, always my favorite, sporting a long green veil with the usual sequel, crutches, and bandaged heads. And yes, the airship. Yards and yards of yellow silk went to make it, and an additional tiny balloon was provided for the sole use of the fortunate midget. At the immense altitude to which the ship reached, the aeronauts huddled together for warmth, while the lost little soloist, still the object of my intense envy notwithstanding his plight, drifted into an abyss of frost and stars alone. 3. I next see my mother, leading me bedward through the enormous hall, where a central flight of stairs swept up and up, with nothing but hothouse-like panes of glass between the upper landing and the light green evening sky. One would lag back and shuffle and slide a little on the smooth stone floor of the hall, causing the gentle hand at the small of one's back to propel one's reluctant frame by means of indulgent pushes. Upon reaching the stairway, my custom was to get to the steps by squirming under the handrail between the newel post and the first banister. With every new summer, the process of squeezing through became more difficult. Nowadays, even my ghost would get stuck. Another part of the ritual was to ascend with closed eyes. "Step, step, step," came my mother's voice as she led me up. And sure enough, the surface of the next tread would receive the blind child's confident foot. All one had to do was lift it a little higher than usual, so as to avoid stubbing one's toe against the riser. This slow, somewhat somnambulistic ascension in self-engendered darkness held obvious delights. The keenest of them was not knowing when the last step would come. At the top of the stairs, one's foot would be automatically lifted to the deceptive call of step, and then, with a momentary sense of exquisite panic, with a wild contraction of muscles, would sink into the phantasm of a step, padded, as it were, with the infinitely elastic stuff of its own non-existence. It is surprising what method there was in my bedtime dawdling. True, the whole going-up-the-stairs business now reveals certain transcendental values. Actually, however, I was merely playing for time by extending every second to its utmost. This would still go on when my mother turned me over to be undressed to Miss Clayton or Mademoiselle. There were 5 bathrooms in our country house, and a medley of venerable washstands. One of these I would seek out in its dark nook whenever I had been crying, so as to feel on my swollen face, which I was ashamed to show, the healing touch of its groping jet while I stepped on the rusty pedal. Regular baths were taken in the evening. For morning ablutions, the round, rubber English tubs were used. Mine was about 4 feet in diameter, with a knee-high rim. Upon the lathered back of the squatting child, a jug full of water was carefully poured by an aproned servant. Its temperature varied with the hydrotherapeutic notions of successive mentors. There was that bleak period of dawning puberty when an icy deluge was decreed by our current tutor, who happened to be a medical student. On the other hand, the temperature of one's evening bath remained pleasantly constant at 28 degrees Réaumur, 95 degrees Fahrenheit, as measured by a large kindly thermometer whose wooden sheathing, with a bit of damp string in the eye of the handle, allowed it to share in the buoyancy of celluloid goldfishes and little swans. The toilets were separate from the bathrooms, and the oldest among them was a rather sumptuous but gloomy affair, with some fine panel work and a tasseled rope of red velvet, which, when pulled, produced a beautifully modulated, discreetly muffled gurgle and gulp. From that corner of the house one could see Hesperus and hear the nightingales, and it was there that later I used to compose my youthful verse, dedicated to unembraced beauties, and morosely survey, in a dimly illuminated mirror, the immediate erection of a strange castle in an unknown Spain. As a small child, however, I was assigned a more modest arrangement, rather casually situated in a narrow recess between a wicker hamper and the door leading to the nursery bathroom. This door I liked to keep ajar, Through it I drowsily looked at the shimmer of steam above the mahogany bath, at the fantastic flotilla of swans and skiffs, at myself with a harp in one of the boats, at a furry moth pinging against the reflector of the kerosene lamp, at the stained-glass window beyond, at its two halberdiers consisting of colored rectangles. Bending from my warm seat, I liked to press the middle of my brow, its ophrion to be precise, against the smooth, comfortable edge of the door, and then roll my head a little so that the door would move to and fro while its edge remained all the time in soothing contact with my forehead. A dreamy rhythm would permeate my being. The recent step, step, step would be taken up by a dripping faucet, and fruitfully combining rhythmic pattern with rhythmic sound, I would unravel the labyrinthian frets on the linoleum and find faces where a crack or a shadow afforded a point de repère for the eye. I appeal to parents, never, never say hurry up to a child. The final stage in this course of my vague navigation would come when I reached the island of my bed. From the veranda or drawing room, where life was going on without me, my mother would come up for the warm murmur of her goodnight kiss. Closed inside shutters, a lighted candle, gentle Jesus, meek and mild, something-something little child, the child kneeling on the pillow that presently would engulf his humming head. English prayers and the little icon featuring a sun-tanned Greek Catholic saint formed an innocent association upon which I look back with pleasure, and above the icon, high up on the wall, where the shadow of something, of the bamboo screen between bed and door, undulated in the warm candlelight, a framed aquarelle showed a dusky path winding through one of those eerily dense European beechwoods, where the only undergrowth is bindweed and the only sound one's thumping heart. In an English fairy tale my mother had once read to me, a small boy stepped out of his bed into a picture and rode his hobby horse along a painted path between silent trees. While I knelt on my pillow in a mist of drowsiness and talc-powdered well-being, half-sitting on my calves and rapidly going through my prayer, I imagined the motion of climbing into the picture above my bed and plunging into that enchanted beech wood, which I did visit in due time. 4. A bewildering sequence of English nurses and governesses, some of them wringing their hands, others smiling at me enigmatically, come out to meet me as I re-enter my past. There was a dim Miss Rachel, whom I remember mainly in terms of Huntley and Palmer biscuits, the nice almond rocks at the top of the blue-papered tin box, the insipid cracknels at the bottom, which she unlawfully shared with me after my teeth had been brushed. There was Miss Clayton, who, when I slumped in my chair, would poke me in the middle vertebrae and then smilingly throw back her own shoulders to show what she wanted of me. She told me a nephew of hers at my age, 4, used to breed caterpillars, but those she collected for me in an open jar with nettles all walked away one morning, and the gardener said they had hanged themselves. There was lovely black-haired, aquamarine-eyed Miss Norcott, who lost a white kid glove at Nice or Beaulieu, where I vainly looked for it on the shingly beach among the colored pebbles and the glaucous lumps of sea-changed bottle glass. Lovely Miss Norcott was asked to leave at once one night in Abazia. She embraced me in the morning twilight of the nursery, pale mackintoshed and weeping like a Babylonian willow, and that day I remained inconsolable, despite the hot chocolate that the Petersons' old nanny had made especially for me and the special bread and butter, on the smooth surface of which my aunt Nata, adroitly capturing my attention, drew a daisy, then a cat, and then the little mermaid whom I had just been reading about with Miss Norcott and crying over, too, so I started to cry again. There was myopic little Miss Hunt, whose short stay with us in Wiesbaden came to an end the day my brother and I, aged 4 and 5 respectively, managed to evade her nervous vigilance by boarding a steamer that took us quite a way down the Rhine before recapture. There was pink-nosed Miss Robinson. There was Miss Clayton again. There was one awful person who read to me Marie Corelli's The Mighty Atom. There were still others. At a certain point, they faded out of my life. French and Russian took over, and what little time remained for the speaking of English was devoted to occasional sessions with two gentlemen, Mr. Burness and Mr. Cummings, neither of whom dwelt with us. They are associated, in my mind, with winters in St. Petersburg, where we had a house on the Morskaya Street. Mr. Burness was a large Scotsman with a florid face, light blue eyes, and lank, straw-colored hair. He spent his mornings teaching at a language school, and then crammed into the afternoon more private lessons than the day could well hold. Traveling as he did from one part of the town to another, and having to depend on the torpid trot of dejected izvozchik cab horses to get him to his pupils, he would be, with luck, only a quarter of an hour late for his 2 o'clock lesson, wherever that was, but would arrive after 5 for his 4 o'clock one. The tension of waiting for him and hoping that for once his superhuman doggedness might balk before the gray wall of some special snowstorm was the kind of feeling that one trusts never to meet with in mature life, but that I did experience again when circumstances forced me, in my turn, to give lessons, and when in my furnished rooms in Berlin I awaited a certain stone-faced pupil who would always turn up despite the obstacles I mentally piled in his way. The very darkness that was gathering outside seemed a waste product of Mr. Burness's efforts to reach our house. Presently the valet would come to drop the blue voluminous blinds and draw the flowered window draperies. The tick-tock of the grandfather's clock in the schoolroom gradually assumed a dreary, nagging intonation. The tightness of my shorts in the groin and the rough touch of ribbed black stockings rubbing against the tender inside of my bent legs would mingle with the dull pressure of a humble need, the satisfaction of which I kept postponing. Nearly an hour would pass, and there would be no sign of Mr. Burness. My brother would go to his room and play some practice piece on the piano, and then plunge and replunge into some of the melodies that I loathed, the instruction to the artificial flowers in Faust, Dites-lui qu'elle est belle, or Vladimir Lenski's wail, Kuda, 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 vi udalilis. I would leave the upper floor where we children dwelt, and slowly slide along the balustrade down to the second story, where my parents' rooms were situated. As often as not, they used to be out at that time, and in the gathering dusk the place acted upon my young senses in a curiously teleological way, as if this accumulation of familiar things in the dark were doing its utmost to form the definite and permanent image that repeated exposure did finally leave in my mind. The sepia gloom of an Arctic afternoon in midwinter invaded the rooms and was deepening to an oppressive black. A bronze angle, a surface of glass or polished mahogany here and there in the darkness, reflected the odds and ends of light from the street, where the globes of tall street lamps along its middle line were already diffusing their lunar glow. Gauzy shadows moved on the ceiling. In the stillness, the dry sound of a chrysanthemum petal falling upon the marble of a table made one's nerves twang. My mother's boudoir had a convenient oriel for looking out on the Morskaya in the direction of the Maria Square. With lips pressed against the thin fabric that veiled the window pane, I would gradually taste the cold of the glass through the gauze. From that oriel, some years later, at the outbreak of the Revolution, I watched various engagements and saw my first dead man. He was being carried away on a stretcher, and from one dangling leg an ill-shod comrade kept trying to pull off the boot despite pushes and punches from the stretcherman, all this at a goodish trot. But in the days of Mr. Burness's lessons there was nothing to watch save the dark, muffled street and its receding line of loftily suspended lamps, around which the snowflakes passed and repassed with a graceful, almost deliberately slackened motion, as if to show how the trick was done and how simple it was. From another angle one might see a more generous stream of snow in a brighter, violet-tinged nimbus of gaslight, and then the jutting enclosure where I stood would seem to drift slowly up and up like a balloon. At last one of the phantom sleighs gliding along the street would come to a stop, and with gawky haste Mr. Burness, in his fox-furred shapka, would make for our door. From the schoolroom, whither I had preceded him, I would hear his vigorous footsteps crashing nearer and nearer. And no matter how cold the day was, his good ruddy face would be sweating abundantly as he strode in. I remember the terrific energy with which he pressed on the spluttering pen as he wrote down, in the roundest of round hands, the tasks to be prepared for the next day. Usually at the end of the lesson, a certain limerick was asked for and granted, the point of the performance being that the word screamed in it was to be involuntarily enacted by oneself every time Mr. Burness gave a formidable squeeze to the hand he held in his beefy paw as he recited the lines. There was a young lady from Russia who squeeze whenever you'd crush her. She squeeze and she squeeze, by which time the pain would have become so excruciating that we never got any farther. 5. The quiet bearded gentleman with a stoop, old-fashioned Mr. Cummings, who taught me in 1907 or 1908 to draw, had been my mother's drawing master also. He had come to Russia in the early 90s as foreign correspondent and illustrator for the London Graphic. Marital misfortunes were rumored to obscure his life. A melancholy sweetness of manner made up for the meagerness of his talent. He wore an ulster, unless the weather was very mild, when he would switch to the kind of greenish-brown woolen cloak called a loden. I was captivated by his use of the special eraser he kept in his waistcoat pocket, by the manner in which he held the page taut, and afterwards flicked off with the back of his fingers the gutticles of the percha, as he said. Silently, sadly, he illustrated for me the marble laws of perspective. Long, straight strokes of his elegantly held, incredibly sharp pencil caused the lines of the room he created out of nothing, abstract walls, receding ceiling and floor, to come together in one remote hypothetical point with tantalizing and sterile accuracy. Tantalizing because it made me think of railway tracks, symmetrically and trickily converging before the bloodshot eyes of my favorite mask, a grimy engine driver. Sterile, because that room remained unfurnished and quite empty, being devoid even of the neutral statues one finds in the uninteresting first hall of a museum. The rest of the picture gallery made up for its gaunt vestibule. Mr. Cummings was a master of the sunset. His little watercolors, purchased at different times for 5 or 10 rubles apiece by members of our household, led a somewhat precarious existence, shifting as they did to more and more obscure nooks, and finally getting completely eclipsed by some sleek porcelain beast or a newly framed photograph. After I had learned not only to draw cubes and cones, but to shade properly with smooth merging slants such parts of them as had to be made to turn away forever, the kind old gentleman contented himself with painting under my enchanted gaze his own wet little paradises, variations of one landscape. A summer evening with an orange sky, a pasture ending in the black fringe of a distant forest, and a luminous river repeating the sky and winding away and away. Later on, from around 1910 to 1912, the well-known Impressionist, a term of the period, Yaremich, took over. A humorless and formless person, he advocated a bold style. Blotches of dull colors, smears of sepia and olive brown, by means of which I had to reproduce on huge sheets of gray paper humanoid shapes that we modeled of plasticine and placed in dramatic positions against a back cloth of velvet with all kinds of folds and shadow effects. It was a depressing combination of at least 3 different arts, all approximative, and finally I rebelled. He was replaced by the celebrated Dobuzhinsky, who liked to give his lessons on the piano nobile of our house, in one of its pretty reception rooms downstairs, which he entered in a particularly noiseless way, as if afraid to startle me from my verse-making stupor. He made me depict from memory, in the greatest possible detail, objects I had certainly seen thousands of times without visualizing them properly. A street lamp, a post box, the tulip design on the stained glass of our own front door. He tried to teach me to find the geometrical coordinations between the slender twigs of a leafless boulevard tree, a system of visual give and takes requiring a precision of linear expression, which I failed to achieve in my youth, but applied gratefully in my adult instar, not only to the drawing of butterfly genitalia during my 7 years at the Harvard Museum of Comparative Zoology, when immersing myself in the bright wellhole of a microscope to record in India ink this or that new structure, but also perhaps to certain camera lucida needs of literary composition. Emotionally, however, I am still more indebted to the earlier color treats given me by my mother and her former teacher. How readily Mr. Cummings would sit down on a stool, parked behind with both hands his, what, was he wearing a frock coat? I see only the gesture, and proceed to open the black tin paint box. I loved the nimble way he had of soaking his paintbrush in multiple color to the accompaniment of a rapid clatter produced by the enamel containers wherein the rich reds and yellows that the brush dimpled were appetizingly cupped. And having thus collected its honey, it would cease to hover and poke, and by two or three sweeps of its lush tip would drench the Vatmajnsky paper with an even spread of orange sky, across which, while that sky was still dampish, a long purple-black cloud would be laid. "And that's all, dearie," he would say. "That's all there is to it." On one occasion, I had him draw an express train for me. I watched his pencil ably evolve the cowcatcher and elaborate headlights of a locomotive that looked as if it had been acquired second-hand from the Trans-Siberian Line after it had done duty at Promontory Point, Utah, in the 60s. Then came five disappointingly plain carriages. When he had quite finished them, he carefully shaded the ample smoke coming from the huge funnel, cocked his head, and after a moment of pleased contemplation, handed me the drawing. I tried to look pleased, too. He had forgotten the tender. A quarter of a century later, I learned two things. That Burness, by then dead, had been well known in Edinburgh as a scholarly translator of the Russian romantic poems that had been the altar and frenzy of my boyhood, and that my humble drawing master, whose age I used to synchronize with that of granduncles and old family servants, had married a young Estonian girl about the time I myself married. When I learned these later developments, I experienced a queer shock. It was as if life had impinged upon my creative rights by wriggling on beyond the subjective limits so elegantly and economically set by childhood memories that I thought I had signed and sealed. "And what about Yaromich?" I asked M.V. Duborzhinsky one summer afternoon in the 1940s as we strolled through a beech forest in Vermont. "Is he remembered?" "Indeed he is," replied Mstislav Valerianovich. "He was exceptionally gifted. I don't know what kind of teacher he was, but I do know that you were the most hopeless pupil I ever had." Chapter 5 1 I have often noticed that after I had bestowed on the characters of my novels some treasured item of my past, it would pine away in the artificial world where I had so abruptly placed it. Although it lingered on in my mind, its personal warmth, its retrospective appeal had gone, and presently it became more closely identified with my novel than with my former self, where it had seemed to be so safe from the intrusion of the artist. Houses have crumbled in my memory as soundlessly as they did in the mute films of yore, and the portrait of my old French governess, whom I once lent to a boy in one of my books, is fading fast, now that it is engulfed in the description of a childhood entirely unrelated to my own. The man in me revolts against the fictionist, and here is my desperate attempt to save what is left of poor Mademoiselle. A large woman, a very stout woman, Mademoiselle rolled into our existence in December 1905 when I was 6 and my brother 5. There she is. I see so plainly her abundant dark hair, brushed up high and covertly graying, the three wrinkles on her austere forehead, her beetling brows, the steely eyes behind the black-rimmed pince-nez, that vestigial mustache, that blotchy complexion, which in moments of wrath develops an additional flush in the region of the third and amplest chin so regally spread over the frilled mountain of her blouse. And now she sits down, or rather she tackles the job of sitting down, the jelly of her jowl quaking, her prodigious posterior, with the three buttons on the side, lowering itself warily. Then, at the last second, she surrenders her bulk to the wicker armchair, which, out of sheer fright, bursts into a salvo of crackling. We had been abroad for about a year, after spending the summer of 1904 in Beaulieu and Abbazia, and several months in Wiesbaden. We left for Russia in the beginning of 1905. I fail to remember the month. One clue is that in Wiesbaden I had been taken to its Russian church, the first time I had been to church anywhere, and that might have been in the Lenten season. During the service I asked my mother what were the priest and deacon talking about. She whispered back in English that they were saying we should all love one another, but I understood she meant that those two gorgeous personages in cone-shaped, shining robes were telling each other they would always remain good friends. From Frankfurt, we arrived in Berlin in a snowstorm, and next morning caught the Nord Express, which thundered in from Paris. 12 hours later, it reached the Russian frontier. Against the background of winter, the ceremonial change of cars and engines acquired a strange new meaning. An exciting sense of Rodina, motherland, was for the first time organically mingled with the comfortably creaking snow, the deep footprints across it, the red gloss of the engine stack, the birch logs piled high under their private layer of transportable snow on the red tender. I was not quite 6, but that year abroad, a year of difficult decisions and liberal hopes, had exposed a small Russian boy to grown-up conversations. He could not help being affected in some way of his own by a mother's nostalgia and a father's patriotism. In result, that particular return to Russia, my first conscious return, seems to me now, 60 years later, a rehearsal, not of the grand homecoming that will never take place, but of its constant dream in my long years of exile. The summer of 1905 in Vera had not yet evolved Lepidoptera. The village schoolmaster took us for instructive walks. "What you hear is the sound of a scythe being sharpened. That field there will be given a rest next season. Oh, just a small bird, no special name. If that peasant is drunk, it is because he is poor." Autumn carpeted the park with varicolored leaves, and Miss Robinson showed us the beautiful device which the ambassador's boy, a familiar character in her small world, had enjoyed so much the preceding autumn, of choosing on the ground and arranging on a big sheet of paper such maple leaves as would form an almost complete spectrum, minus the blue, a big disappointment. Green shading into lemon, lemon into orange, and so on through the reds to purples, purplish browns, reddish again, and back through lemon to green, which was getting quite hard to find except as a part, a last brave edge. The first frosts hit the asters, and still we did not move to town. That winter of 1905 to 1906, when Mademoiselle arrived from Switzerland, was the only one of my childhood that I spent in the country. It was a year of strikes, riots, and police-inspired massacres, and I suppose my father wished to keep his family away from the city, in our quiet country place, where his popularity with the peasants might mitigate, as he correctly surmised, the risks of unrest. It was also a particularly severe winter, producing as much snow as Mademoiselle might have expected to find in the Hyperborean gloom of remote Muscovy. When she alighted at the little Siversky station, from which she still had to travel 6 miles by sleigh to Vera, I was not there to greet her. But I do so now, as I try to imagine what she saw and felt at that last stage of her fabulous and ill-timed journey. Her Russian vocabulary consisted, I know, of one short word, the same solitary word that years later she was to take back to Switzerland. This word, which in her pronunciation may be phonetically rendered as gide, actually it's gde, with e as in yet, meant where, and that was a good deal. Uttered by her like the raucous cry of some lost bird, it accumulated such interrogatory force that it sufficed for all her needs. Gidier! Gidier! She would wail, not only to find out her whereabouts, but also to express supreme misery. The fact that she was a stranger, shipwrecked, penniless, ailing, in search of the blessed land where at last she would be understood. I can visualize her by proxy as she stands in the middle of the station platform where she has just alighted, and vainly my ghostly envoy offers her an arm that she cannot see. There I was, abandoned by all, comme la Comtesse Karenine, she later complained eloquently, if not quite correctly. The door of the waiting room opens with a shuddering whine peculiar to nights of intense frost. A cloud of hot air rushes out, almost as profuse as the steam from the panting engine. And now our coachman Zahar takes over, a burly man in sheepskin with the leather outside, his huge gloves protruding from his scarlet sash into which he has stuffed them. I hear the snow crunching under his felt boots while he busies himself with the luggage, the jingling harness, and then his own nose, which he eases by means of a dexterous tweak and shake of finger and thumb as he trudges back around the sleigh. Slowly, with grim misgivings, Mademoiselle, as her helper calls her, climbs in, clutching at him in mortal fear lest the sleigh move off before her vast form is securely encased. Finally, she settles down with a grunt and thrusts her fists into her skimpy plush muff. At the juicy smack of their driver's lips, the two black horses, Zoika and Zinka, strain their quarters, shift hooves, strain again, and then Mademoiselle gives a backward jerk of her torso as the heavy sleigh is wrenched out of its world of steel, fur, flesh, to enter a frictionless medium where it skims along a spectral road that it seems barely to touch. For one moment, thanks to the sudden radiance of a lone lamp where the station square ends, a grossly exaggerated shadow, also holding a muff, races beside the sleigh, climbs a billow of snow, and is gone, leaving Mademoiselle to be swallowed up by what she will later allude to with awe and gusto as Le Steppe. There, in the limitless gloom, the changeable twinkle of remote village lights seems to her to be the yellow eyes of wolves. She is cold. She is frozen stiff. Frozen to the center of her brain, for she soars with the wildest hyperbole when not tagging after the most pedestrian dictum. Every now and then, she looks back to make sure that a second sleigh bearing her trunk and hatbox is following, always at the same distance, like those companionable phantoms of ships in polar waters which explorers have described. And let me not leave out the moon, for surely there must be a moon, the full, incredibly clear disk that goes so well with Russian lusty frosts. So there it comes, steering out of a flock of small dappled clouds, which it tinges with a vague iridescence. And as it sails higher, it glazes the runner tracks left on the road, where every sparkling lump of snow is emphasized by a swollen shadow. Very lovely. Very lonesome. But what am I doing in this stereoscopic dreamland? How did I get here? Somehow, the two sleighs have slipped away, leaving behind a passportless spy standing on the blue-white road in his New England snow boots and storm coat. The vibration in my ears is no longer their receding bells, but only my old blood singing. All is still, spellbound, enthralled by the moon, fancy's rear-vision mirror. The snow is real, though. And as I bend to it and scoop up a handful, 60 years crumble to glittering frost dust between my fingers. 2. A large alabaster-based kerosene lamp is steered into the gloaming. Gently it floats and comes down. The hand of memory, now in a footman's white glove, places it in the center of a round table. The flame is nicely adjusted, and a rosy, silk-flounced lampshade, with inset glimpses of rococo winter sports, crowns the readjusted cotton wool in Casimir's ear light. Revealed, a warm, bright, stylish Russian Empire drawing room in a snow-muffled house, soon to be termed Le Chateau, built by my mother's grandfather, who, being afraid of fires, had the staircase fashioned of iron, so that when the house did get burned to the ground, sometime after the Soviet Revolution, those fine-wrought steps, with the sky shining through their open-work risers, remained standing, all alone, but still leading up. Some more about that drawing room, please. The gleaming white moldings of the furniture, the embroidered roses of its upholstery, the white piano, the oval mirror, hanging on taut cords, its pure brow inclined, it strives to retain the falling furniture and the slope of bright floor that keeps slipping from its embrace. The chandelier pendants. These emit a delicate tinkling. Things are being moved in the upstairs room where Mademoiselle will dwell. Colored pencils. Their detailed spectrum advertised on the box, but never completely represented by those inside. We are sitting at a round table, my brother and I and Miss Robinson, who now and then looks at her watch. Roads must be dreadful with all that snow. And anyway, many professional hardships lie in wait for the vague French person who will replace her. Now the colored pencils in action. The green one, by a mere whirl of the wrist, could be made to produce a ruffled tree, or the eddy left by a submerged crocodile. The blue one drew a simple line across the page, and the horizon of all seas was there. A nondescript, blunt one kept getting into one's way. The brown one was always broken, and so was the red, but sometimes, just after it had snapped, one could still make it serve by holding it so that the loose tip was propped none too securely by a jutting splinter. The little purple fellow, a special favorite of mine, had got worn down so short as to become scarcely manageable. The white one alone, that lanky albino among pencils, kept its original length, or at least did so until I discovered that, far from being a fraud leaving no mark on the page, it was the ideal implement, since I could imagine whatever I wished while I scrawled. Alas, these pencils, too, have been distributed among the characters in my books to keep fictitious children busy. They are not quite my own now. Somewhere in the apartment house of a chapter, in the hired room of a paragraph, I have also placed that tilted mirror, and the lamp, and the chandelier drops. Few things are left. Many have been squandered. Have I given away Box the First, son and husband of Lulu, the housekeeper's pet, that old brown dachshund fast asleep on the sofa? No, I think he is still mine. His grizzled muzzle with the wart at the puckered corner of the mouth is tucked into the curve of his hock, and from time to time a deep sigh distends his ribs. He is so old, and his sleep is so thickly padded with dreams, about chewable slippers and a few last smells, that he does not stir when faint bells jingle outside. Then a pneumatic door heaves and clangs in the vestibule. She has come after all. I had so hoped she would not. 3. Another dog, the sweet-tempered sire of a ferocious family, a Great Dane not allowed in the house, played a pleasant part in an adventure that took place on one of the following days, if not the very day after. It so happened that my brother and I were left completely in charge of the newcomer. As I reconstitute it now, my mother had probably gone, with her maid and young trainee, to St. Petersburg, a distance of some 50 miles, where my father was deeply involved in the grave political events of that winter. She was pregnant and very nervous. Miss Robinson, instead of staying to break in Mademoiselle, had gone too, back to that ambassador's family, about which we had heard from her as much as they would about us. In order to prove that this was no way of treating us, I immediately formed the project of repeating the exciting performance of a year before when we escaped from poor Miss Hunt in Wiesbaden. This time the countryside all around was a wilderness of snow, and it is hard to imagine what exactly could have been the goal of the journey I planned. We had just returned from our first afternoon walk with Mademoiselle, and I was seething with frustration and hatred. With a little prompting, I had meek Sergei share some of my anger. To keep up with an unfamiliar tongue, all we knew in the way of French were a few household phrases, and on top of it to be crossed in all our fond habits, was more than one could bear. The bonne promenade she had promised us had turned out to be a tedious stroll near the house where the snow had been cleared and the icy ground sprinkled with sand. She had had us wear things we never used to wear, even on the frostiest day, horrible gaiters and hoods that hampered our every movement. She had restrained us when I induced Sergei to explore the creamy, smooth swellings of snow that had been flower beds in summer. She had not allowed us to walk under the organ pipe-like system of huge icicles that hung from the eaves and gloriously burned in the low sun. And she had rejected as ignoble one of my favorite pastimes, devised by Miss Robinson. Lying prone on a little plush sledge with a bit of rope tied to its front and a hand in a leathern mitten pulling me along a snow-covered path under white trees, and Sergei, not lying but sitting on a second sledge upholstered in red plush attached to the rear of my blue one, and the heels of two felt boots right in front of my face, walking quite fast with toes slightly turned in, now this, now that sole skidding on a raw patch of ice. The hand and feet belonged to Dmitri, our oldest and shortest gardener, and the path was the avenue of oaklings, which seems to have been the main artery of my infancy. I explained to my brother a wicked plan and persuaded him to accept it. As soon as we came back from that walk, we left Mademoiselle puffing on the steps of the vestibule and dashed indoors, giving her the impression that we were about to conceal ourselves in some remote room. Actually, we trotted on till we reached the other side of the house, and then, through a veranda, emerged into the garden again. The above-mentioned Great Dane was in the act of fussily adjusting himself to a nearby snowdrift, but while deciding which hind leg to lift, he noticed us and at once joined us at a joyful gallop. The three of us followed a fairly easy trail, and after plodding through deeper snow, reached the road that led to the village. Meanwhile, the sun had set. Dusk came with uncanny suddenness. My brother declared he was cold and tired, but I urged him on and finally made him ride the dog, the only member of the party to be still enjoying himself. We had gone more than 2 miles, and the moon was fantastically shiny, and my brother, in perfect silence, had begun to fall every now and then from his mount, when Dmitri, with a lantern, overtook us and led us home. "Gidier! Gidier!" Mademoiselle was frantically shouting from the porch. I brushed past her without a word. My brother burst into tears and gave himself up. The Great Dane, whose name was Turka, returned to his interrupted affairs in connection with serviceable and informative snowdrifts around the house. 4. In our childhood, we know a lot about hands, since they live and hover at the level of our stature. Mademoiselles were unpleasant because of the froggy gloss on their tight skin besprinkled with brown, ecchymotic spots. Before her time, no stranger had ever stroked my face. Mademoiselle, as soon as she came, had taken me completely aback by patting my cheek in sign of spontaneous affection. All her mannerisms come back to me when I think of her hands. Her trick of peeling rather than sharpening a pencil, the point held toward her stupendous and sterile bosom swathed in green wool, the way she had of inserting her little finger into her ear and vibrating it very rapidly, the ritual observed every time she gave me a fresh copybook, always panting a little, her mouth slightly open and emitting in quick succession a series of asthmatic puffs, she would open the copybook to make a margin in it, that is, she would sharply imprint a vertical line with her thumbnail, fold in the edge of the page, press, release, smooth it out with the heel of her hand, after which the book would be briskly twisted around and placed before me, ready for use. A new pen followed. She would moisten the glistening nib with susurrus lips before dipping it into the baptismal ink font, then delighting in every limb of every limpid letter, especially so because the preceding copybook had ended in utter sloppiness, with exquisite care I would inscribe the word dictée while Mademoiselle hunted through her collection of spelling tests for a good, hard passage. 5. Meanwhile, the setting has changed. The berimed tree and the high snowdrift with its xanthic hole have been removed by a silent property man. The summer afternoon is alive with steep clouds breasting the blue. Eyed shadows move on the garden paths. Presently, lessons are over, and Mademoiselle is reading to us on the veranda, where the mats and plaited chairs develop a spicy, biscuity smell in the heat. On the white window ledges, on the long window seats covered with faded calico, the sun breaks into geometrical gems after passing through rhomboids and squares of stained glass. This is the time when Mademoiselle is at her very best. What a number of volumes she read through to us on that veranda. Her slender voice sped on and on, never weakening, without the slightest hitch or hesitation. An admirable reading machine, wholly independent of her sick bronchial tubes. We got it all. Les Malheurs de Sophie, Le Tour du Monde en 80 jours, Le Petit Chose, Les Misérables, Le Comte de Monte Cristo, many others. There she sat, distilling her reading voice from the still prison of her person. Apart from the lips, one of her chins, the smallest but true one, was the only mobile detail of her Buddha-like bulk. The black-rimmed pince-nez reflected eternity. Occasionally a fly would settle on her stern forehead, and its three wrinkles would instantly leap up all together like three runners over three hurdles. But nothing whatever changed in the expression of her face, the face I so often tried to depict in my sketchbook, for its impassive and simple symmetry offered a far greater temptation to my stealthy pencil than the bowl of flowers or the decoy duck on the table before me, which I was supposedly drawing. Presently my attention would wander still farther, and it was then, perhaps, that the rare purity of her rhythmic voice accomplished its true purpose. I looked at a tree, and the stir of its leaves borrowed that rhythm. Yegor was pottering among the peonies. A wagtail took a few steps, stopped as if it had remembered something, and then walked on, enacting its name. Coming from nowhere, a comma butterfly settled on the threshold, basked in the sun with its angular, fulvous wings spread, suddenly closed them just to show the tiny initial chalked on the dark underside, and as suddenly darted away. But the most constant source of enchantment during those readings came from the harlequin pattern of colored panes inset in a whitewashed framework on either side of the veranda. The garden, when viewed through these magic glasses, grew strangely still and aloof. If one looked through blue glass, the sand turned to cinders, while inky trees swam in a tropical sky. The yellow created an amber world, infused with an extra strong brew of sunshine. The red made the foliage drip ruby dark upon a pink footpath. The green soaked greenery in a greener green, and when, after such richness, one turned to a small square of normal, savorless glass, with its lone mosquito or lame daddy longlegs, it was like taking a draught of water when one is not thirsty, and one saw a matter-of-fact white bench under familiar trees. But of all the windows, this is the pane through which in later years parched nostalgia longed to peer. Mademoiselle never found out how potent had been the even flow of her voice. The subsequent claims she put forward were quite different. "Ah," she sighed, "comment s'aimer, didn't we love each other? Those good old days in the chateau. The dead wax doll we once buried under the oak. No, a wool-stuffed gollywog. And that time you and Serge ran away and left me stumbling and howling in the depths of the forest." Exaggerated. "Ah, la fessée que je vous ai flanquée! My, what a spanking I gave you." She did try to slap me once, but the attempt was never repeated. "Votre tante, la princesse, whom you struck with your little fist because she had been rude to me." "Do not remember." "And the way you whispered to me your childish troubles." "Never." "And the nook in my room where you loved to snuggle because you felt so warm and secure." Mademoiselle's room, both in the country and in town, was a weird place to me. A kind of hothouse sheltering a thick-leaved plant imbued with a heavy, enuretic odor. Although next to ours, when we were small, it did not seem to belong to our pleasant, well-aired home. in that sickening mist, reeking among other woollier effluvia of the brown smell of oxidized apple peel, the lamp burned low, and strange objects glimmered upon the writing desk. A lacquered box with licorice sticks, black segments of which she would hack off with her penknife and put to melt under her tongue. A picture postcard of a lake and a castle, with mother-of-pearl spangles for windows. A bumpy ball of tightly rolled bits of silver paper that came from all those chocolates she used to consume at night. Photographs of the nephew who had died, of his mother, who had signed her picture Mater Dolorosa, and of a certain Monsieur de Marant, who had been forced by his family to marry a rich widow. Lording it over the rest was one in a fancy frame encrusted with garnets. It showed in three-quarter view a slim young brunette clad in a close-fitting dress, with brave eyes and abundant hair. A braid as thick as my arm and reaching down to my ankles, was Mademoiselle's melodramatic comment. For this had been she, but in vain did my eyes probe her familiar form to try and extract the graceful creature it had engulfed. Such discoveries as my awed brother and I did make merely increased the difficulties of that task, and the grown-ups who during the day beheld a densely clothed Mademoiselle never saw what we children saw when, roused from her sleep by one of us shrieking himself out of a bad dream, disheveled, candle in hand, a gleam of gilt lace on the blood-red dressing-gown that could not quite wrap her quaking mass, the ghastly Jezebel of Racine's absurd play stomped barefoot into our bedroom. All my life, I have been a poor go-to-sleeper. People in trains, who lay their newspaper aside, fold their silly arms, and immediately, with an offensive familiarity of demeanor, start snoring, amaze me as much as the uninhibited chap who cozily defecates in the presence of a chatty tubber, or participates in huge demonstrations, or joins some union in order to dissolve in it. Sleep is the most moronic fraternity in the world, with the heaviest dues and the crudest rituals. It is a mental torture I find debasing. The strain and drain of composition often force me, alas, to swallow a strong pill that gives me an hour or two of frightful nightmares, or even to accept the comic relief of a midday snooze, the way a senile rake might totter to the nearest euthanasium. But I simply cannot get used to the nightly betrayal of reason, humanity, genius. No matter how great my weariness, the wrench of parting with consciousness is unspeakably repulsive to me. I loathe Somnus, that black-masked headsman binding me to the block. And if in the course of years, with the approach of a far more thorough and still more risible disintegration, which now a nights, I confess, detracts much from the routine terrors of sleep, I have grown so accustomed to my bedtime ordeal as almost to swagger while the familiar axe is coming out of its great velvet-lined double bass case. Initially, I had no such comfort or defense. I had nothing, except one token light in the potentially refulgent chandelier of Mademoiselle's bedroom, whose door, by our family doctor's decree, I salute you, Dr. Sokolov, remained slightly ajar. Its vertical line of lambency, which a child's tears could transform into dazzling rays of compassion, was something I could cling to, since in absolute darkness my head would swim and my mind melt in a travesty of the death struggle. Saturday night used to be, or ought to have been, a pleasurable prospect, because that was the night Mademoiselle, who belonged to the classical school of hygiene and regarded our tocade anglaise as merely a source of colds, indulged in the perilous luxury of a weekly bath, thus granting a longer lease to my tenuous gleam. But then a subtler torment set in. We have moved now to our townhouse, an Italianate construction of Finnish granite, built by my grandfather circa 1885, with floral frescoes above the third upper story, and a second-floor oriel in St. Petersburg, now Leningrad, 47 Morskaya, now Herzen Street. The children occupied the third floor. In 1908, the year selected here, I still shared a nursery with my brother. The bathroom assigned to Mademoiselle was at the end of a Z-shaped corridor some 20 heartbeats distance from my bed, and between dreading her premature return from the bathroom to her lighted bedroom next to our nursery, and envying my brother's regular little wheeze behind the Japan screen separating us, I could never really put my additional time to profit by deftly getting to sleep while a chink in the dark still bespoke a speck of myself in nothingness. At length they would come, those inexorable steps, plodding along the passage and causing some fragile glass object, which had been secretly sharing my vigil, to vibrate in dismay on its shelf. Now she has entered her room. A brisk interchange of light values tells me that the candle on her bed-table takes over the job of the ceiling cluster of bulbs, which, having run up with a couple of clicks two additional steps of natural and then supernatural brightness, clicks off altogether. My line of light is still there, but it has grown old and wan, and flickers whenever Mademoiselle makes her bed creak by moving. For I still hear her. Now it is a silvery tussle spelling Suchard. Now the trick, trick, trick of a fruit knife, cutting the pages of La Revue des Deux Mondes. A period of decline has started. She is reading Bourget. Not one word of his will survive him. Doom is nigh. I am in acute distress, desperately trying to coax sleep, opening my eyes every few seconds to check the faded gleam, and imagining paradise as a place where a sleepless neighbor reads an endless book by the light of an eternal candle. The inevitable happens. The pince-nez case shuts with a snap. The review shuffles onto the marble of the bed-table, and gustily Mademoiselle's pursed lips blow. The first attempt fails. A groggy flame squirms and ducks. Then comes a second lunge, and light collapses. In that pitchy blackness, I lose my bearings. My bed seems to be slowly drifting. Panic makes me sit up and stare. Finally, my dark-adapted eyes sift out, among entoptic floaters, certain more precious blurrings that roam in aimless amnesia, until, half-remembering, they settle down as the dim folds of window curtains behind which streetlights are remotely alive.